morning. My name is Therese, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the ISDA Credit Operations Strategic Restructuring Update call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. I would now like to turn the call over to Ms. Nicole Ramulero. You may begin, Nicole.
Thank you. Good day and welcome. My name is Nicole Ramulero with the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. I'm joined by my distinguished colleagues, Lee Silverwood from Barclays and Andy Byatt from DTCC, who will be providing an update in regard to the operational best practices for strategic restructuring on today's call. Before we get started, I just have a couple of housekeeping items that I'd like to mention. Today's call will be recorded and will be made available on the ISDA website as soon as possible. As the operator indicated, all of the lines are muted until the end of the call. If you would like to ask a question, please hit star one, and we will take questions at the end. And ISDA will prepare a frequently asked questions document based on the questions that we get from today's call. With that, I'd like to hand over to Lee, who's going to provide an overview in regard to the operational best practices. Lee?
Thanks, Nicole, and thank you all for joining the call today in relation to strategic restructuring. Now, just a little bit of background. Obviously, the small bang took place last year, followed quickly by the Thompson credit event, where we utilized the current bankruptcy and failure to pay infrastructure within DTCC to process a restructuring credit event. The best practice is obviously published on the ISDA website for that, and we now have best practices in place for clear transactions as well for using the current infrastructure. Today's call is to introduce you to the strategic restructuring infrastructure that will be placed within DTCC during September. We'll be looking at the concepts and the functionality of that infrastructure. We won't actually be going into the detail of the, obviously the GUI screens, etc. And there is a full training schedule that has been put together pre-UAT and also during UAT when we'll be having further training sessions, very more specific training sessions to introduce you to the actual GUI screens, etc., and the actual processes. Just one small point. If anyone does have any questions, then if you could store those up till the end of this this meeting, and then we can answer any questions at the end. The presentation will actually, most of the heavy lifting will be done by Andy Byatt, and I'll actually hand over to Andy now.
Thanks, Ali. As was mentioned, we currently have a tactical approach for restructuring events, which leverages our bankruptcy and failure to pay infrastructure in the warehouse. This presentation deals with the next stage of development for that, whereby we're introducing new functionality so that we can deal with restructuring in a more strategic approach. So hopefully everyone received the presentation that went out with this meeting invitation, and we'll be working through that presentation document as we go through on this call. We're going to start really with page three, which provides an overview of the documentation that's available on this release and the headline dates for this project. So looking first at the dates, let's work backwards. So we're looking at a production release for this functionality on the 24th of September of this year. And during the working group discussions on strategic restructuring, there was a industry buy-in to use this strategic approach as soon as possible after that production release date. Now we have an approximate 6-week period for external UAT, so user testing, which is due to start on the 12th of August. Now that's going to be a scripted UAT process whereby our colleagues at MarketServe and the UAT teams there will be delivering a scripted 6-week program of testing, which will be open to anyone to be involved with. And that scripted UAT testing will go through each of the functional parts of the strategic restructuring approach. Now we're actually aiming to have the scripts for that user acceptance testing program available about a month prior to the UAT. So that's actually coming up very, very soon in mid-July. And they'll be running regular working group calls to work through those scripts, agree any changes before the start of the UAT on the 12th of August. Now, to kind of run in line with that, to try and make sure that people are up to speed on how to use this new functions in the warehouse, we'll be looking to do some initial user training, again, starting mid-July. And really, this presentation is the start of that process. So the aim of this presentation is to give you a high-level overview of the functionality that's being introduced. And the user training that will be available from the 19th of July will really delve deeper into looking at the screens themselves, looking at the messaging, and taking you through in detail each step in that process. That user training will involve in-house training for the larger dealers and webinar-based and seminar-based training for other users as well. But throughout that process, if anyone has any questions on this strategic approach, then the team at DTCC will be on hand to provide extra information as and when it's needed. Now, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, there is a lot of documentation available on this release, the majority of which is published on our DerivServe website in the participant section, and I've provided the URL for that at the bottom of page 3. Just got run through the documents. We've mentioned in here a business requirements document. We haven't sent that round with this presentation, but actually the best way of looking at this is to look at the functional specifications, which really build out from those requirements. So the functional specifications contain all of the business requirements and delve even deeper to go through the exact functional specs. So that document is a very good document to get a very detailed view of the functionality and how each of the processes work and interact. Then the technical specifications and the MQ message schemas go through the messaging formats and choreography in great detail. So those two documents are aimed predominantly at your tech development groups. So if you're looking to hook up to the warehouse restructuring via MQ, then those are the documents that you want to look at. Now, in line with a lot of the messaging that we do within the warehouse, as well as MQ, you can also send in submissions via CSV upload. And the last two documents there are providing those templates that will be used for that upload procedure. So again, if you'll be looking at doing triggering for restructuring events via spreadsheet upload, that's the best place for you to actually look at how that spreadsheet will be formatted. Now that participant section is password protected. If you're currently a participant on the DerivServe warehouse, you should probably already have a password for that. If you don't or you don't know your password to that, again, feel free to contact us at DTCC and I'll provide an email address for you to do so and we can help you access that. If we've got people on the line at the moment who aren't DTCC participants, then again, we'd encourage you to contact us directly and we can take you through the process of getting access to that information and onboarding to the warehouse. Okay, moving on then to slide 4. This is just a very quick summary of the functional modules that we're going to talk through the rest of this presentation. So we're going to run through the event master record, which is the core record in the warehouse that looks to hold all the details on that event. And then we're going to go through untouched index reversioning, and then really the meat of the presentation is on the triggering methodology for restructuring events. And then towards the end, we'll talk through automatic rebooking and adherence to the auction and processing events, as well as looking at the reports and the GUI. Additionally, towards right at the end, we'll go through some additional requirements that we've put in place for restructuring triggering for clearinghouse transactions. So I'll leave that to the end because I know that doesn't actually affect everyone on this call. So hopefully we'll go through the meat of the presentation first. Okay, looking at slide 5 then, we'll start by looking at the event master record. Now, this is the very first thing that will happen in the warehouse as soon as an event is determined by the ISTA DC. And this becomes the central record in the warehouse where we will look to record all of the important information on that event. So that initially will cover the event default date, the event determination date, and the reference entity name that's been affected, and the type of restructuring event, whether it be a mod R or an old R event. But then throughout the life of that particular restructuring event, as and when more details become available, that event master record will be updated with things such as the index reversioning dates, the triggering deadlines, movement option deadlines, maturity bucket dates, and then ultimately the auction date and cash settlement date. It will also hold information of the reference deliverable obligations and the indices and the successor codes that will be used on this event. So it really becomes a fairly important record and a central place whereby you can very quickly and very easily pick up all of the pertinent information for that event. Now that's going to be available via the existing event processing dashboard in the warehouse. So if you have access already to our event processing dashboard, you'll automatically be able to see and delve into that master record throughout the life of that particular event. So that really covers, and I think one of the main differences between the strategic approach and the tactical approach is that under the tactical, we use anything up to 13 different events throughout the life of that restructuring event to record all of those details. So the main difference here really under the strategic approach is very nearly all of the processing is going to get done under this one event master record. So it provides a central hub for you for all that processing. So then moving on then to slide six, we start looking at the first process that takes place under that event master record. And that's the spinning off of the component single name transaction and the reversioning of any untranched index transactions. So in accordance with the ISTA protocol, triggering on restructuring events takes place only on the single name transactions and tranche transactions. So untranched index transactions need to have the component entity stripped from it and rebooked as a single name CDS trade upon which you can then trigger that transaction. Now, under the tactical approach, we do this by creating two or three individual credit event master records, and we pick three days where we will reversion your untranched index transactions. And those particular dates are generally agreed with the credit implementation group. Now, the agreeing of those dates will still stick with that credit implementation group, but instead, under the strategic approach, we will agree a range of dates on which we will, on a nightly basis, look to reversion any of your affected untranched index trades. So we'll have a process start date and a process end date, and each day we will, on during that time, we will look into the warehouse for any index transactions which are affected by the event and reversion them accordingly. You won't need to do anything to have your transactions affected by that reversioning process. Effectively, it's an auto adherence, whereby we will pick them up automatically by referring to the details held in the event master record, and then we reversion them at the end of that evening. Now, the reason we have a range of dates to do this on is that if we only did this on one day, if your record in the warehouse was uncertain or unconfirmed, we wouldn't be able to update it. So we do envisage that the vast majority of your index trades will be reversioned on the first day, but then if there are any exceptions on that first day, it gives you a couple of days of opportunity to get that trade into a certain or match status so that that process will then automatically reversion it for you. Now that's the reversioning of your untranched index trade, but the secondary part of that is the booking of the spun-off single name component transaction, the single name CDS trade. Now, throughout the requirements capture, this was debated at some length, and the decision was taken that rebooking of the single name trade shouldn't be done automatically by the warehouse, but should remain a manual process for participants to book that transaction into the warehouse. So from a timing perspective, it's important that manual rebooking of that component trade take place during this same processing window for the reversioning, so that between the single name trade and the reversion trade, your position remains flat.
Andy, just one thing to add to this. I know you've alluded to the fact that we did discuss this in some detail within the Strategic Restructuring Working Group. Both buy side and dealers agreed that they wanted to keep control over the booking process for these single names, and obviously the submission of their own static data, whether it be MCA or matrix standards to DTCC versus their counterparties. That was the main driver for actually maintaining the control within firm systems rather than having DTCC also create those single names. So you know, just to confirm, it has been debated in detail and agreed by everybody in the industry that the way forward is to book those yourselves and submit those for bilateral confirmation.
Okay, thanks, Lee. Okay, so that's the end of the first phase of processing under a restructuring event. Once that's taken place, the ISDC will be taking a look at the deliverable obligations, and that may take a number of days, or even under Thompson, I think it's stretched out to a number of weeks. But really the next point of processing on this event in the warehouse is when those deliverable obligations are agreed, and we reopen up the triggering windows. Now, this is really where we get into the meat of how you trigger your transactions. So it's important to understand a few features of the restructuring events themselves. So under the small bang, all of your transactions need to be triggered on a trade-by-trade basis to that particular event, and you can actually partially trigger transactions to this event as well. So this is not going to be like a bankruptcy or failure to pay event whereby we automatically adhere your trades for you. This is a trading decision to apply a particular transaction, a triggerable transaction, to this event and then have it processed by that event itself. Now, we enable this triggering by introducing a new triggering message. As we alluded to a little while earlier, normally with these messages in the warehouse, we enable you to do this in three different ways. One is via MQ messages. So if you link up to the warehouse via MQ for FPML messages, then there is a new format for triggering and for movement options whereby you can electronically trigger your transactions via FPML and have that affect the warehouse transactions. And that's where we mentioned the documentation. We have example schemas available so that you can code to those new messages. In addition to that, if you're not looking to hook up to the warehouse via MQ, you can upload your trigger transactions via a spreadsheet, so a CSV formatted spreadsheet. And again, as mentioned before, the template for that is available on our participants' website. You can upload multiple transactions in one upload, but that methodology is also available to you. Now, the third way of triggering is via the GUI itself. Now, this is where one of the main differences comes in the strategic approach, in that adherence to bankruptcy and failure to pay events is available via our event processing dashboard. But the restructuring triggering is going to be available only via a new GUI, the triggering GUI, which is going to be available via a new O-code. Now, those of you that have access to our event processing dashboard will be able to see you will be able to see the messages come through, but you won't be able to instigate a trigger via that dashboard. You would need to have access to the triggering GUI itself. And the reason for really separating this out is that many firms wanted to be able to put that triggering functionality only in their front office and not within their operations group, or to put it within their middle office, or make a specific decision as to who can have access to actually trigger their transactions, because as we mentioned before, this is much more of a trading decision. So this GUI separates that triggering activity. So again, if you have access to event processing, you'll be able to see the triggering activity, but you won't be able to initiate it. If you've got access to the new triggering GUI, you will be able to see activity as well as initiate that triggering as well. Okay, so we move on then to types of triggering. There are two major triggering event types, the first one being CEN, and this kind of maps back to a very similar terminology that we use for the tactical approach as well, so hopefully it's fairly familiar. So CEN stands for Credit Event Notice, and the important feature of this particular message is that it is the legal delivery of your credit event notice. It can be a full trigger or partial trigger, but it is the legal notification of you triggering this particular transaction to that event. So you don't need to follow it up with faxes or emails. The submission of that trigger is your legal trigger. Now, under the ISTA protocol, although you need to deliver this credit event notice, the protocol itself doesn't stipulate the methodology that you use for that triggering. So although there has been an industry agreement to use the warehouse for this triggering activity, you are not forced to do so by the ISTA protocol. So it is currently possible for you to either send or receive a trigger on a restructuring event outside of the warehouse. So someone could fax it to you or send it by email, etc. To cover that particular scenario, we use this notify CEN. And either party can send this notify in, and that notify tells the warehouse that a legal trigger on a warehouse record has taken place outside of the warehouse. So if you've received a fax from the seller of the transaction initiating a seller trigger, you as the buyer can send in the notify CEN instructing us that an outside seller trigger has taken place. So the important feature of this is that the notify CEN is not your legal trigger. The original either fax or email trigger that you've received is your legal trigger. The notify is simply a notification to the warehouse that that trigger has taken place. Now, the third message type we'll come on to in a little bit, but that's the movement option as well, but we'll come on to that one. Now, an important feature to understand about these three message types, the credit event notice, the notify CEN, and the movement, is that they are what we call unilateral messages. All of the messages currently that we submit via DS Match in the warehouse are matching messages. So if you send it in, it goes to an unconfirmed status, your counterparty sees it as alleged, and when your counterparty submits it or agrees it, it will move to confirmed status. For the triggering events and the movement options, those statuses no longer apply because they are unilateral messages. They don't require them to be matched, and they will never go to a confirmed status. So all we really do when someone submits a trigger is that we record that trigger and tell your counterparty about it. So we've got new statuses for these unilateral messages. The first one being rejection. So if you submit a trigger which is in an incorrect format, if it's formed incorrectly, so that the warehouse can't understand the trigger message, then we will reject it. And in that case, only the submitter will get that rejection message. If you're sending the trigger in and it processes successfully, then you will get a status of delivered. So a confirmation that your trigger has successfully been delivered. And if you are the receiver, then you will be told about that message and the status of that message will be received. So again, these are never matched. You don't need to confirm them. You simply are notified that that message has been sent to you or been sent by you. A couple of notes really just at the bottom of this page. One is on tranches. Now, as we mentioned a little bit earlier, you can partially trigger a transaction. So part of this trigger message is the amount of the trigger that you are sending in. So if you have a 100 million transaction, you can submit a trigger and tell us that it's for 50 million of that transaction. Now, the ISTA protocol has a paragraph in it which states that triggering on tranche transactions should only ever be on the relevant entity notional amount, or RENA, rather than the notional amount of the transaction. And it is a slightly different number. So we make a presumption that any triggers that come in on tranche transactions are adhering to that rule in the ISTA protocol. So if you send in a trigger on a tranche trade and the trigger says 10 million, that's going to be 10 million of relevant entity notional amount, not notional. And a last piece on validation. We mentioned that if the message is malformed that we would reject it. But there is another reason that we would reject an incoming trigger. And that's by applying one of the ISTA protocol rules, which is regarding minimum trigger amounts. Now, under a mod-R or mod-R event, the protocol states that there is a minimum trigger amount of 1 million currency units and multiples thereof, or for the full notional of that transaction. So as well as validating that we can understand the message, at this point we also say, is it a valid trigger amount? So is it either a multiple of 1 million currency units, or is it for the full trade notional? If it's not, we'll reject it at that point, and your counterparty will never see that trigger. But you will obviously be notified that that rejection has taken place. The important point here is that we don't apply any of the other protocol triggering rules at this point in time. All we're doing at this point is taking this message in, saying, is it an understandable message? If so, we'll register that into the warehouse and we'll inform your counterparty about it. But we haven't at this point applied it to the transaction, and we'll come onto that shortly. But before we get onto that, I want to cover the movement option messages, which is covered on slide 8. So, mentioned before the three message types, movement option is the third one. For movement options, you use exactly the same methodology for submitting them, so MQ, CSV upload, or via the triggering GUI only. But there are a couple of differences. Firstly, there's no notify version of a movement option at this point in time. It's the only way of telling a movement option in a warehouse transaction and have it affect the warehouse trade at this point is to submit a movement option message. Again, it's a unilateral message. It will never be confirmed. But under the rules of the ISTA protocol, you can't partially exercise your movement option. So if you've got a 10 million transaction which is eligible for a movement option, you can only move that full transaction, so no partial movement options. One last one is that if for some reason you submit a movement option, but we're not actually within the movement option period, we will reject that message for you and your counterparty won't see it. So if it's actually invalid because you're preempting the movement option time, we will reject that message. Okay, then at the bottom of page 8, we've got a couple of features, again, which apply to all three message types. We will, if you are hooked up to our MQ links, inform you via MQ of any incoming triggers. So if you are hooked up to listen to those MQ messages, you will get real-time updates on any incoming messages, be they triggers, notifiers, or movement options. The information that's provided on those MQ messages, and indeed on the reports in the GUI, will confirm the time of submission to the warehouse of that trigger, not the time we process it. And this is a switch from our tactical process. So under the tactical approach, we could only ever show you the time that we processed it. Under strategic, it will be the time that your counterparty submitted that trigger. And then on that message, we'll include both TRIs if they're known. So an important point on triggering is that you can trigger an unconfirmed transaction. But at that point in time, if it is unconfirmed, we don't know what the trade reference number is for your counterparty. So we'll only include that on certain records where we know what that information is. Okay, and the last piece really on this actual triggering message itself is with regard to disables. Now, in the ISTA protocol itself, it states that triggering messages and movement options are irrevocable. So once they're submitted, there's no going back. That transaction, that trigger is applied, and that's it. There is, however, in the marketplace, a slightly unofficial process of forgiving accidental triggers. And we've seen this in action in the three or four restructuring events that have taken place in the last 6 or 7 months. So it felt that we needed to be able to offer a way of reflecting that forgiving process in the warehouse. And we do this via disables. Now, most of you will be kind of familiar with disables in our confirmation activity. And it's very similar in this. So despite the fact that triggering and movement messages are unilateral, so only one of you ever needs to submit it, if you're looking to disable a trigger, then that's still a matched process. Now, you can only actually instigate a disable if you're the person that sent it. So if you send the trigger and go, oh, I did that accidentally, you can submit a request to disable that trigger. Your counterparty will need to approve the disabling of that trigger. And then if they approve that, then our operations group will then apply that disable and prevent that trigger record affecting the underlying transaction. Now, obviously, there's a deadline to be able to do this, and we come to a point in the process in the life cycle of that event where after triggering, we start spinning off transactions, and that's really the deadline. for disabling any triggering, because as soon as we started creating new trades off the back of that triggering activity, it will be too late to disable that trigger. Okay, so that's covered the new message types. And one of the things we mentioned earlier is the fact that we transmit that message to your counterparty as soon as we receive it. And we do that before we actually look at the impact of that trigger on the underlying transaction. And the reason we do that is that there's a lot of sensitivity around triggering deadlines, particularly in the last 5 to 10 minutes of triggering. So in order to ensure that trigger message is passed on to you as the counterparty in as fast a method as we possibly can, we separate the passing on of that message to the actual processing of it on your transaction. And that's really what we get onto on slide 9, is looking at, once we've passed that message on, how do we apply it to that underlying transaction? So when we do this application, what we're really doing is looking to apply all of the variety of triggering rules that are stipulated in the ISTA protocol. So, for example, it's at this point where we will look to see if that trigger was done within the appropriate deadlines. And this is an important point in that if someone has sent you a trigger and it's after the deadline, we'll still record that in the warehouse and show it to you so that you can see that that message had been sent and received, and you'll see that it was after the deadline. But when we actually go through the application of that trigger to your transaction, when we look at these rules, we'll see that it's post-deadline, and we will never apply that trigger to your trade. We'll also then look at the ISTA protocol trumping rules. So the first 2 days of triggering, seller triggers trump buyer triggers. And we'll look at that when we actually apply it to the transaction as well. In addition to looking at how much notional is available to be triggered, and the status of your transactions. Now, there are a raft of validation and application rules that you can see in our functional specifications. I think those four kind of cover the majority of them, but again, I'd encourage you to take a look through that document to see the exact rules that we use for the application. Now, what we don't do at this point is send you another MQ to show you the application of that trigger to that trade. You can, however, see in the GUI in near real time how we apply that transaction, and we've produced new reports frequently throughout the day that provide you with updates on all of your trigger rule transactions and the effects of any triggering that's taken place. But if you do hook up via MQ, all we do with our messages is inform you of when triggering takes place. We don't via MQ show you how that's applied. Okay, so we mentioned then that you can take a look at the impact of this triggering or in near real time via the GUI. And we do that via an event summary window. So for those of you that are conversant already with our bankruptcy and failure to pay processing, when you look at a transaction that's been adhered to an event, there's an additional window called the event processing window that will show you that that transaction is adhered. Now, under the strategic approach, we're expanding that information so that you can see both the triggering messages that are sent on that trade and the impact of those triggering messages on that transaction. The first part of that information is for every single message, triggering message or movement message on that transaction, we'll give it a status to show you whether it's been fully applied or whether we could only partially apply the amount that's being triggered, or whether for some reason it's not applied to that transaction at all. Now, a trigger would be not applied for a number of reasons. Firstly, you know, if it's outside of the triggering window, as we mentioned before, if it's post the deadline, we still record it, but we won't apply it to it. Although it may not be available notional there to be triggered. So what we've done on slide 10 is to try to give you an example of what that event summary window will look like. So starting at the top of slide 10, we show you how this event summary window would look before any triggering activity takes place. So you'll see there in the first box that there's no triggering messages. Just see the headlines, there's no triggering message in there. We've got 100 million transaction. So when you take a look at the triggering positions on that trade, you'll see that the full 100 million is untriggered, and there's no buyer trigger or seller trigger there. So that's pretty much how all of your trades will start off before any of the triggering activity takes place. Second section of that example shows you that on T plus 1 or triggering plus 1, we've got a buyer trigger coming in for 30 million. So that first box shows you that message, shows you who submitted it, whether they're the buyer or seller, the time that they submitted it, the type of message, so was it a legal event notice or was it a notify or a movement option, the amount on that trigger, and whether we've applied it or not. And then the impact of that trigger is shown to you in the triggering position box just beneath. So if you've got the 100 million transaction, we've got an incoming buyer trigger of 30 million. You see very quickly there we've got a 70 million untriggered notional, the 30 million buyer triggered notional. And in this example, we have shown you that that buyer trigger has been applied to the 7-year maturity bucket. So we apply to that maturity bucket by looking at the dates for those maturity buckets that we have entered into the event master record and which will be published by the ISTA DC committee. Okay, so looking at the last stage of that example, we have a second message coming in on the second day of triggering. We receive a trigger in from the seller for 80 million. Now, as we mentioned before, there are trumping rules for triggering in the ISTA protocol that state in the first 2 days of triggering a seller trigger trumps. So in this particular example, when you look at the messages, you'll see the messages in chronological order. So you've got our original buyer trigger shown first, and then underneath it, that seller trigger coming in at a later point in time. But when you take a look at the status fields on the far right-hand side, you'll see that the seller trigger has been fully applied, but we actually changed the status on the original buyer message to show that we could only partially apply that message now. And that's shown fully in the last box there for the triggering positions, showing that when we've applied both of these trigger messages, there's no untriggered notional left available. We've fully applied that seller trigger for 80 million to the 20 plus year bucket. And we've then applied what was left of the notional that was available to that incoming buyer trigger, showing a buyer trigger amount of 20 million, again to that 7-year bucket. So that's a fairly straightforward example of the messaging and how we apply it to that transaction and how we show it to you on the GUI. Now, when you take a look at the functional specifications, there's a whole raft of different examples that goes through slightly more complex scenarios. But hopefully that's given everyone an overview of how that functionality works. Okay, that was one of the reasons that example is fairly simple is because it's all using credit event notices. So what we want to look at is how we treat notify messages differently. And that's what we really cover on slides 11 and 12. So just to reiterate what we mentioned before, a notify message is where you're indicating to us that a legal trigger on a warehouse record has taken place outside of the warehouse. So either party can submit it and tell us whether it's a buyer or seller trigger. And the default action for us in the warehouse when you submit a notify message is to show you that message on our event window, event summary window, so it will be displayed alongside all of the other triggers, again in chronological order. But the default status for that triggering message is to be unapplied. So at that point in time, if one of you submitted the notify to tell us it's taken place, we will then simply show that message but not apply it. Now the difference with the notify event is that if you are the receiver of that message, you'll be presented with an option to instruct the warehouse to apply that transaction. Now when you do that, what you're doing is confirming that you agree that that trigger was sent outside of the warehouse and that it was a legal trigger sent within the deadlines for that trigger type. So you can have a scenario whereby the seller triggers you via email a couple of minutes before the seller trigger deadline, and then one of those parties submits that notify after that seller deadline. But when you actually inform us to apply it, what you're doing is agreeing that that notify trigger took place before the deadline and should therefore be applied as a legal trigger. Sorry, not a legal trigger. It's applied as a valid trigger. So as soon as you actually do that, as soon as you click on that button to say apply this notify transaction, we will then go through exactly the same validation process and go through exactly the same protocol rules to then reassess all of those messages on that transaction to apply them to that transaction. And that's really what we've done with our example on page 12. I won't go through that, but I'll let people take a look at that. And again, on our functional specifications, there are a number of examples around these scenarios available for you to look through. So we've taken a look really at how the triggering messages are applied. Now, one of the things we've mentioned there is that kind of subsequent triggering can cause us to reapply previous messages. So you could have a message that's fully applied, and then subsequent triggering can actually make us look at that again and reapply or unapply that trigger message. But on page 13, we go through the fact that post-trade events can also trigger us to reassess how those trigger messages are applied to your transaction. Now, most of these are common sense in their approach. So, for example, for an exit, if you're taking that transaction out of the warehouse, we'll still keep all of those trigger messages for you on the audit trail so that you can see them. But we'll automatically unapply them. So it basically takes that transaction out of that process because you've taken it out of the warehouse. And that makes sense. The tricky one really is the next one, which is the partial assignments. And that's the one that I really want to walk people through. Now, there's three possible scenarios under a partial assignment. First of all, you could be partially assigning a trade during a restructuring event, but there's been no previous triggering on that transaction. And in that particular scenario, all we're going to do is process that partial assignment as normal. You'll get a reduction on your existing notional amount, and you'll get a new transaction for the new leg on that assignment. Again, that new leg will not show any triggering. It won't be applied, but it will be available for triggering for that new counterparty. If you're partially assigning a trade when it's either fully buyer-triggered or fully seller-triggered, then again, that partial assignment will process as normal. But what we do is we carry forward all of that triggering, all those triggering messages and all of the audit trail details. We maintain it on your old record, your reduced record, and they're carried over onto that new partially assigned record as well. And then you are fully applied to that particular event. So if you've got a 10 million transaction that's fully buyer-triggered, you partially assign 5 million of it. You'll get the messages on that original transaction reflected on both of those new trades, so your reduced trade and your new leg, and both of them will remain fully buyer-triggered. But the tricky one is when you've got a partial assignment during a restructuring event where you've got partial triggering. And under that scenario, we don't have the information as to whether you're partially assigning the triggered portion or the untriggered portion or a mixture. So in that particular scenario, what we do is we carry over all of the messages onto the new leg, as well as retaining them on the old leg, but we will automatically unapply any of those messages. So you'll have them available in the audit trail to see, but we won't include it in the automatic processing under that restructuring event. And that will be because we don't know which party holds the triggered part of that transaction at that point in time. Now, there is a method to be able to reintroduce that trade into the auction process at a later point in time. We'll cover that shortly. But it's important to note that at this point in time, it will show as untriggered. You'll see the triggering messages, but they won't be applied. Okay, so that hopefully gets us to the end of the triggering period. Now, one of the important processes that takes place at the end of the triggering period is the spinning off of partially triggered transactions. And this is detailed in the Small Bank Protocol itself. So it states there that if you've got a transaction which is triggered and it's both buyer and seller triggered, then those transactions count as being separate transactions. So what we do in the warehouse, at the end of day on the triggering deadline date, is that we will take a look at all of your triggerable transactions and assess if we need to take any action on them at that point in time. Now, if your transaction is untriggered, we don't do anything with it. It stays as it is. And also, if it's fully buyer-triggered or fully seller-triggered, again, it stays exactly as it is. will only do something to that transaction at this point if you've got partial triggering of any kind. So if you've got a half buyer, half seller, or if you've got some buyer triggering, some seller triggering, and some untriggered activity. What we'll do at that point in time is we will spin that transaction off into a number of trades to reflect those different triggered shapes. So if, for example, you've got a transaction which has 10 million untriggered, 20 million buyer triggered, and 30 million seller triggered, then at the end of this process, what we'll do is we'll have created three trades for you from that original. One in your 10 million untriggered shape, one in your 20 million buyer triggered shape, and one in your 30 million seller triggered shape. Again, when we spin those transactions off, we will carry forward all of the messaging history onto those new trades, and we will then apply in accordance to those triggering messages. So the shape we create for your buyer triggers will automatically be applied to the appropriate maturity bucket for buyer triggered trades, and accordingly, any seller trigger will be applied to your seller trigger maturity bucket. So for non-cleared transactions in this case, the most number of trades in that which will get created will be three transactions. Bottom of page 14 goes through kind of the process of how that takes place, which I won't go through on this call, but I'll leave that for people to look through. Again, in the functional specifications, that's gone through in great detail with regards to what happens on particular fields on those transactions. We then really come to the last piece of the process under the phase one for strategic restructuring. As most of you will be aware, under the tactical approach, we currently create a separate credit event for each of the maturity buckets that's going to have an auction. And we retain that process in phase one for strategic restructuring. So we will, again, create a separate credit event for each maturity bucket that's going to have an auction. But the last piece of the automated process is that between the date when those events are created in the warehouse and the auction date for that particular event, we will automatically and on a daily basis scan the database of affected transactions, and any transactions which are triggered to that particular maturity bucket, we will adhere for you on both sides of the trades to the relevant auction processing event. So if you've sent in your CEN messages and you're triggered, and we spin off a transaction, we carry forward that triggering information. When we create that auction processing event, we'll take that transaction and adhere it for you. In all other respects, those auction processing events are standard bankruptcy failure to pay type processing events. So you can manually adhere additional transactions to them, or you can manually unadhere transactions from each of those events. And this is really where you'll take action on particular transactions, like the ones we went through with partial assignments, whereby you know that they are triggered, but we can't in the warehouse determine the effects of that triggering. You can reflect that by amending those transactions into the shapes of triggered amounts, and then manually adhering to the auction processing events to reintegrate them into that automatic processing for the cash settlement of those auction results. Now, if you do have any transactions which are untriggered, so single name trades that are untriggered, for example, when we get to the end of that, those transactions will stay exactly as they are. And you know, if they're in a maturity bucket which doesn't have an auction, again, they stay as they are, and you'll drop back to fallback settlement method. So that really kind of takes us to the end of the actual processing for non-cleared transactions. I think what I'd like to do at that point really is skip through to slide 19, which is just going through a couple of reports that are available. We mentioned before that if you're hooked up to our NQ messaging, you'll get real-time updates on any triggering activity, and that you can also get real-time updates on that triggering via the GUI, as well as how it's applied to your transactions. But the other way of looking at that information and reconciling it back is by looking at the regular reports that we're going to be creating throughout the life of that event. But one of those new reports is the triggering status report, which again is generated on multiple times a day throughout that process. And that will show you every single message or triggering message that is received on any transaction under that event, and then also show you a representation of the event summary window, which will show you how those messages are applied and the impact on your transaction. So it will show you how much is untriggered, how much is buyer triggered, where it's and which bucket it's assigned to, and how much it is sale triggered, etc. The second report there that's available to you is the summary report, which again will show you every single individual transaction that's triggered, but it will then give you a summary of bucketed information. So it will show you how many transactions, how much notional is triggered to each maturity bucket, and what those underlying transactions are. Then the third report on there is an internal report for DTCC, which kind of brings together all of the triggering activity under that event across all parties, and buckets that information down so that we can provide regular updated information to the ISTA Determinations Committee on triggering activity so that they can make a determination as to whether any particular auction bucket is going to have an auction or not. That particular report is only available to us, and we will use that in our communications with ISTA DC. The page 20 again goes over in summary the details of the new triggering GUI, which I won't go into particular detail, but just as a reminder, it will require a separate digital certificate, and that was at the request of the participants, so that you can very accurately control who has access to trigger your transactions. And that GUI will include a number of different sections. It's going to show you an extract from the Event Master record showing you the most pertinent dates, so it will act as a reminder as to when your triggering deadlines are, for example. It will give you a list of transactions that we see as being triggerable under that event. It will enable you to trigger them on there, and it will also show you in real time any incoming triggering messages that will flash up on that screen to inform you that that trigger has taken place. So again, the functional specifications go through that in great detail, so I shall leave that for people to take a look through. And that really covers the full functionality for non-cleared transactions. So at that point, I think we should go back to slide 17 and 18, which tries to provide you a quick introduction to what we're doing for clearinghouse transactions. It's on slide 16, 17 and 18. So looking at slide 16, in summary, the main driver for a clearinghouse at all times is going to be to remain in a flat position. And under a restructuring event, the clearers need to make sure that they remain flat with regards to any triggering activity on those transactions. So we've looked to introduce functionality into the strategic approach that enables those clearing houses that use the warehouse to remain flat under a restructuring event. And this works by allowing the clearing houses to load in tables of what we call restructuring match pairs. And those match pairs link together a trade or a proportion of a transaction to another trade or another proportion of a transaction against another dealer against that same clearing house. So if you have dealer one has a transaction against the clearinghouse can load into our tables the fact that that dealer one trade or a part of that dealer one trade is matched together with a transaction against a dealer number two. But they can start loading this restructuring and match pair information pretty much as soon as the event is available. And they can load that in, and they will then approve it and make that active in the warehouse. And the assumption is that this process will take place so that all of their clearinghouse positions will have a restructuring match pair entry by the time that we actually reach the point of triggering activity, so the day after the publication of the final list of deliverable obligations. Now what we do with this information is that once that triggering activity starts, is that any trigger that comes in on a transaction which is against a clearinghouse will inform the warehouse to look onto these restructuring match pair tables to see which transaction it's matched off against. So if dealer one sends into the warehouse a trigger on that transaction, we'll send that message off to the clearinghouse. We'll then take a look at the restructuring match pairs and see that it's matched off against the trade with dealer two. The warehouse will then automatically generate a trigger on behalf of that clearinghouse and transmit that to dealer two. Again, clearinghouse will obtain a delivered message on that particular trigger, and DNF2 will get a received message. The important point here is that message that we create on the clearinghouse's behalf will have the same timestamp as the one that came in to them from dealer one. And the other important factor is that all three parties are then electronically informed of that trigger. The dealer one gets their delivered message. Clearinghouse gets both a received and then a delivered message on the automatic generated one. And dealer two gets their received message on that trigger that's passed on. And this is actually what's going to enable the clearinghouse to remain flat throughout this triggering process. We do have a couple of additional rules with regards to this clearinghouse triggering activity. First is a fairly straightforward one in that at this point in time, the only participants that can load a restructuring match payer table for passing on triggers is a clearinghouse entity. And that any triggers that anyone submits against a clearinghouse before those restructuring match pairs are available in the warehouse will be rejected. Another important point is that notifier messages will also be rejected. The clearinghouses that use the warehouse have indicated that electronic triggering on their transactions is only eligible via the warehouse. So notifier messages will be rejected. And then the last point on that is that we talked through the automatic trade spin-off process for partial triggering. Just a note here that we will create an individual transaction at that spin-off process for every restructuring matched pair that has partial triggering activity. So you could have a very large single position against the clearinghouse, say €1 billion on one transaction, that's part of very many restructuring matched pairs. So that when we do this automated spin-off, that €1 billion transaction could be split off into a many number of transactions at that point in time. So slides 17 and 18 try and take a look and work through an example of that clearinghouse triggering, which again I won't go through at this point. Again, in the functional specifications there are a couple of examples there that walk through it, but I'm very aware that obviously that only impacts a number of people at this point in time, and we will be having separate workshops with those firms to take them through this process in greater detail.
Andy, I just got one point to add on this clearing piece. I just want to make sure that everyone's clear that the actual functionality that will enable you to actually trigger a clearinghouse trade is exactly the same functionality as uncleared trades. So you will be triggering a transaction that faces the clearinghouse within your risk system. And then obviously the RMPs, the match pairs concept, is embedded within DTCC itself. So this concept is embedded within DTCC. The build for each firm will not be different for uncleared or cleared transactions. Thanks, Andy.
Okay. So I think that brings us to an end of this particular presentation. As I mentioned, as we go through towards the UAT period, we will be holding seminars that go through in great detail each of these functional parts and show you the screenshots and actually walk you through the process of how to do that process. But at this point, the aim really is to give you an overview of those functions. So I think at this point, then I'll hand back to Nicole for any other further comments or questions.
Great. Thanks, Andy. Operator, could you please ask if there's any questions on the line for us?
Of course. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. And we'll pause for just a moment. And again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from Casper Sevier.
Hi, Andy. Just had a question about the new O codes that DTCC will create. Is DTCC going to reach out to participants individually, or should we reach out to our representative to be able to set up this O code internally?
There'll actually be two parts to this. Obviously, to take part in the UAT process, you'll need a an O-code to access the UAT version of that new GUI. So what we're going to be doing, as soon as that UAT group starts meeting and we're working through the scripts, we'll make paperwork available at that point in time to apply for an O-code for UAT. So anyone looking to get involved in UAT will be able to get access at that point in time. When we're looking at the production environment, we will be sending out an important notice with in relation to this release, and that will also then walk people through how to reach out to DTCC to apply for that additional I/O code. And then what we'll be looking to do is, if there is a restructuring event that's declared at any point in the future, we will again, in the important notice for that event, include instructions on how to get that access if people don't have it at that point in time.
Thank you.
Actually, Andy, I just want to touch on one point that you just mentioned in relation to a specific restructuring event. If we don't have a restructuring event for, say, for instance, next 6 months after the 24th September release, I'd just like to confirm that we will be one of the parts of the training is to actually run, or DTCC to run, monthly training sessions, monthly webinars. And should we have an event, obviously we will be rerunning all of the credit event training to make sure that everybody is up to date with what's going on, because potentially we may not have an event for 6 months, 9 months, 12 months. I don't know. Maybe we'll have one on the 24th September, but we will be monitoring this and making sure that the training is ongoing.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We're just pausing for a moment. And at this time, I'm not showing any further questions. Are there any closing remarks?
Yep. So thank you, everyone, for participating in today's call. ISDA will make the call recording available on the ISDA website as soon as possible. Additionally, we will put together the couple of questions that we received and make them available on the ISDA website. We'd like to thank, obviously, Lee and Andy for participating and providing the overview today, and thank everyone for dialing in. If you have any questions after the call offline that you would like to ask, please feel free to reach out to any one of us, and we're happy to answer your questions. Thank you again, and we hope everyone has a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining today's ISDA Credit Operations Strategic Restructuring Update Call. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.